Become Nomad podcast, whether you're already a nomad or aspiring to become one, we're here to supply you with relevant information to help keep you on the road, at least until the point where you're going to ask yourself, what am I doing? And I'm sending you my regards from Israel, from Haifa, a beautiful city in the north. And this week's episode is an interview with Amy Scott. Amy has a great blog called Nomadtopia, nomadtopia.com. She also has a podcast. She interviewed hundreds of digital nomads, and she knows a lot about the topic, being a digital nomad herself for a few years already. Yeah, there are a lot of cool insights here. I've taken a few, mainly on the topic of relationships and what the focus should be for people who are actually looking to have a digital nomad lifestyle with a significant other. So a lot of good things there. Also about the topic of how fun it feels to stay in a place where you actually know the language, and how, why those places are actually Amy's recommended places. And that's basically it. I hope you enjoy the interview. Maybe let's start with a small or short introduction about your nomadic lifestyle. How does it look like, and so on?
So I have been location independent since 2004. I've spent that time doing a lot of different things. I've been, you know, just backpacking around without working. I started working for myself and then moved to Argentina and pretty much stayed put in one place for a while. And since 2012, my husband and I have been moving around a fair amount. We've spent anywhere, I guess, between like 2 and 6 months in one place. And then we, you know, do some other traveling besides. And we've been in Southeast Asia. And most recently, we've been staying more on this side of the world. So I'm currently in Mexico.
How is your Spanish, by the way? It's okay?
Yeah, good.
That's great. Yeah, that's one of the advantages of traveling to South America. Everyone that goes there kind of knows the language. And when people are going to Asia, then nobody really bothers with more than the basics. So something that I noticed. And you mentioned that you kind of started alone and then you basically got married. So how much of this period was traveling alone?
Right. Well, and that helped with my Spanish too. My husband's from Argentina. Dating a local always helps. Let's see. So I started out on my round the world trip by myself in 2004. And yeah, pretty much I was traveling by myself, living by myself, you know, all of those things, a couple, you know, short relationships here and there, but nothing very serious, from 2004 until I met him in 2009. So yeah, wow, it's longer than I realized.
Yeah, it's pretty long. I know that, the topic of solo traveling is in the minds of a lot of digital nomads, especially those who want to start and feel like, because it's kind of hard to find someone, unlike traveling, that you can easily, let's say, find someone to travel with for 2 weeks or 1 month. Going on a different lifestyle usually requires someone to kind of do it alone or start at it alone. So did you have any fears when you started, or you just said, I'm going to try and see how it goes? How did this one work?
Yeah. Well, the original idea for my round the world trip, was supposed to be with my boyfriend at the time when I came up with the idea, and we ended up breaking up before the trip happened.
Wow.
So it didn't start out as a plan to be a solo trip, but by the time we broke up, I was so committed to the idea and I just really wanted to do it. And I think I maybe did change my itinerary a little bit. Like in the early days, we had talked about going to like Turkey and Morocco, for example. And I thought like, well, I don't know if I want to be in some of the countries that, you know, don't have some of the same perspective on women as other countries. And I thought maybe that's not how I want to start out traveling by myself. And I'd really never been anywhere but Europe before that. So I was going to be going to a lot of places that were really new to me. So that was the one change I made at the beginning. But you know, other than that, I felt like, you know, I lived in lots of big cities in the US and my usual street smarts, you know, should protect me wherever I am. And I did have a couple people meet up with me along the way. I was also a little nervous about traveling in India by myself. And I actually had two friends from college who came to meet me in India for the first couple of weeks I was there. So yeah, for them, that was just vacation. So they came for a short time. And then my parents came to meet me in Asia. So there were a couple of things like that that were able, you know, to kind of break up all of the solo time. But you know, it was really easy to meet people on the road and I had some really amazing experiences. I'm really glad I ended up, like I said, it's not something I necessarily would have done otherwise, but it just turned out that it was a solo trip and I'm really glad I did have the opportunity to travel by myself.
Yeah, I totally agree. Solo trip surprisingly, you actually meet a lot more people when you're traveling alone. It's not something that you would rationally think of, because when you're traveling alone, you might think, hey, I'm lonely and maybe people will not talk to me. But actually, I noticed once a long time ago, I traveled in Thailand with someone for a month, and I noticed I haven't spoken to anyone else during this month, for, like a substantial, meaningful conversation. But I think that what you mentioned about picking the right destination when you travel alone, especially when you start, is so important, because, for example, you can't go wrong with Europe because Europe is safe and so on. And I think also Asia is a great destination, and you have those places where it's a little bit more challenging. So I guess that for people who are thinking about traveling alone and have a little bit of doubts about it, picking the relaxed places makes a lot of difference. So that's a good one. And I also like the ones about trying to find the family to have the family come over and so on, to break those, at least in the beginning. So those are really cool tips and quite an inspiration, I guess, for a lot of people that are kind of afraid of taking the step alone. Now I wanted to ask you, maybe you can tell us a little bit about a personal subject, like, because one of the things digital nomads have on their mind is the, how do I find my significant other? And I know that this, like I had a recent post about disadvantages of a nomadic lifestyle. And one of them was that it's going to be harder to find someone that shares the same need of this kind of lifestyle. So maybe you can give us tips from what you, from your life, and also from, since you interviewed so many nomads so far, if you can find some kind of a common ground about how do people meet their significant other while doing this lifestyle. Is it usually in advance when you have a couple that are living the normal lifestyle and decide that they want to go on the road together? Or do you hear more stories of people who are on the road and then find a fellow digital nomad? Like, how does it usually work? And maybe you can share from your experience.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, and the people I've talked to for my podcast, the vast majority of the couples started the lifestyle together. So they had already met, you know, and were living kind of a normal life together. And luckily, both got on the same page about, oh, you know, we really want to be living our life in a different way. So it started out either with a long trip or, you know, a sabbatical, something like that, that kind of kickstarted the whole thing. And then they decided to continue traveling. I'm trying to think if I've talked to anybody who actually was living a really nomadic life and met their significant other along the way. One that comes to mind is a woman named Brittany who was already working. She was had a very international life, but she wasn't a nomad per se. She was living in Africa, doing development work or working with an NGO or something like that, and doing some travel and stuff as well, and kind of figuring out what the next step was. And she met a guy who was traveling overland in his camper van and hadn't had, you know, a regular job or a home in like 15 years or something. And she ended up just, you know, they had a really powerful connection right from the beginning, and now they're married and traveling together. In my experience, it's kind of somewhere in the middle. I would have been one of those people who started out, you know, as a couple starting the lifestyle together, and then my boyfriend decided he didn't want to go. And then I ended up moving to Argentina by myself and was pretty stationary. You know, I could be anywhere, but I was really enjoying Buenos Aires and I had no reason to go anywhere else. And so I ended up living there for a couple of years. And, I had some friends who definitely had said, you know, like, don't go do all this crazy stuff by yourself. You should meet somebody first and then go do it. But I don't want to wait for that, you know? And, I found that in the US, like, I think that when you're living a normal life, you're going to meet other people living a normal life, right? And you're more likely to meet people doing interesting things that you might have more of a connection with if you just go do what you want to do. So that was why I just decided I'm just going to move to Argentina and see what happens. And I actually met my husband at a salsa club, like a dance club in a dance class. And you know, that's not at all where I went, because I wanted to learn to salsa, not because I thought I was going to meet anybody interesting. And he actually had a pretty normal life himself at that time. So he was, you know, working in an office and had an IT job. And he just happened to be somebody who was interested in doing something different. And when I started talking to him about, you know, being location independent, being able to work from anywhere, he was really attracted to that idea. And because of his background, you know, was able to translate those skills pretty easily. So our plan from very early on was that we would start being more nomadic and doing more traveling together once he was ready to quit his job. So it's like, on the one hand, it's like I went off to do something different, and you could say that attracted the right person. And yet at the same time, he was not a traveler when I met him. So, you know, it was kind of a mix of those two different experiences in one.
Oh, pretty interesting. So the big insight from here is that if you want to meet a fellow nomad, go for salsa. That might be the big, one of the biggest things. But yeah, it came to mind when I read your blog that you actually met your better half while traveling. And that's something that, like you said, is not that common, because most of the stories I know are two people, a couple that are kind of, okay, we had enough with the normal lifestyle, we're hitting the road together. So your story gives a lot of hope for, I think, for all of us, that you can actually do what you do and meet someone and actually give them the idea of, hey, this lifestyle exists and they might even follow this lifestyle. So that's pretty cool. And you also talked about the importance of staying a longer time, because probably if you would meet your husband while only staying in Buenos Aires for 2 weeks, it wouldn't be enough. So actually what allowed you to, let's say, put the seeds of, hey, let's consider this lifestyle is the ability to stay longer and talk about it. So, wow, that's pretty cool. I take some things for myself as well. That's nice.
Yeah. And yeah, I've definitely talked to some other single nomads who talked about that challenge of when you're moving around a fair amount and you're meeting other nomads, but they are also moving around. It can be hard to get to that point of, you know, I'm actually willing to change my plans for you. You know, like if you were supposed to leave the country next week and that person was going to stay longer, you know, whatever it might be, and saying, okay, well, either I'm going to stay, change my plans, or let's meet somewhere in a couple months. Or, you know, a lot of times I hear about these stories of kind of needing to negotiate those kinds of things.
Oh, it really brings into mind, and I think this is a motive that keeps up coming back, that staying longer makes a lot of sense from economical side, from social side, and also now I understand it also helps on finding your soulmate. So for all you nomads, I guess one of the lessons is, if you go to a place, don't hurry up to leave, because things are gonna be really good if you if you at least give a few places a little bit more time. So that's pretty cool. So maybe a last tip for nomads about that they are looking to find their significant other on other than salsa lessons. What is, let's say if you would, if some people are wondering, where do I find them? Like, what are them, like staying longer? We talked about this, but, and that maybe connects me to another question. Are there really communities of people that you're saying, okay, those are like-minded people, even if it's not for a significant other, but a social circle? Like, what did you see from all the interviews you've done in Nomatopia, of people? What communities are they basically using? What are the most popular ones?
Yeah. Well, let's see. To answer your first question, I think, you know, and this applies no matter where you are in the world and whether you're a nomad or not, but I think it's always best to focus on, you know, just enjoying the activities that are interesting to you. You know, and then you meet other people who want to do the same activities, you know, whether that's going, you know, being in a hiking group or, actually, I know people who've met through like conversation exchange, you know, or like going, actually, one of my friends in Buenos Aires met his wife when he was teaching English and she was one of his students, you know, so being involved in whatever kinds of activities, is always a good place to start. As far as organizations, for me, back in the day, you know, I moved to Argentina in 2007. And couch surfing for me was the primary social network for me, even though, you know, I wasn't looking for a place to stay. I had rented an apartment, but and I think it's changed a bit. The way that they have groups structured for individual cities has changed a bit. But back then in Buenos Aires, especially, there was a really active like social component of it, you know, and I could go into the group on the website and like every day there was something happening, you know, like let's meet in the park for a picnic. I'm going to go to this museum. Who wants to come? You know, I'm having people over for tea, whatever it might be. And I met a ton of people, both locals, expats, other travelers, through couch surfing.
Yeah. Couch surfing is still big on my list as well to meet
yeah.
like-minded people because the, by the way, my first experience in couchsurfing was actually in Buenos Aires as well. And uh-huh. I had my best friend there. We went for ice cream every 2 days. So really cool guy. And also learned a little bit of Spanish because of him. So and he practiced the Hebrew with me. So couchsurfing is still great. Although I don't usually use it for either staying in people's homes or hosting. I use more Airbnb. But for meeting like-minded people,
yeah,
it's great because it's basically a platform where people are saying, hey, we're open-minded to meet people from other countries. That's what ticks, makes us tick. And that's what we're interested of
exactly.
Having conversation and so on. So yeah, I know it changed a little bit and a lot of people are complaining about it, but I guess it's still one of the best ways out there to do that. And what about online communities? Do you know, let's say even on communities that don't meet regularly. I ask this also because you have a very active Facebook group that always come to mind because I knew it before as well. But maybe from your experience on the online element of it, can digital nomads actually create communities that are also online? What would you say on this topic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like a big part of my community and my socializing is online. Both in my own Facebook group. And then there's quite a range of different groups out there now. And, you know, it can also be a way to connect with people in person. In fact, I've met a couple of people in person who I knew about because of my Facebook group and realized that we were going to be in the same place. So I've met up with people in Costa Rica. And where else? Also through other communities, like, you know, just whether it's if you sign up for an online course or you go to an event, like I went to World Domination Summit, which is run by Chris Guillebeau. And, they have a Facebook group and I found somebody through the Facebook group who lived in Malaysia and I got to meet him when we were in Malaysia. And I knew because, you know, he had been to World Domination that we were going to be like-minded, and that he would speak English and, you know, all of those things. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot of opportunities to, and also just, you know, Twitter and searching hashtags on Instagram, like all this kind of stuff can really help you connect with people who might, that you can connect with online first, and then you might have the opportunity to meet them in person at some point.
And now maybe a little bit of, let's discuss the topic of digital nomadism in general. So you've been at it for a few years already. When you look at the history of let's say the trends of what happens from 2004 until now, can you identify that this trend increased substantially? Is it different? The focus is different? Can you give us a little bit of an overview on your views on the topic of where was it and maybe where is it going to be in mm-hmm. a few years from now?
Well, let's see. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when I first decided to travel, you know, so my first focus was on the travel, you know, so I was, and I just came up with this idea, like I'm going to do a round the world trip. And I didn't even know that was a thing until I started doing some searches online. I found a Yahoo group for round the world travel and connected with a lot of people through that. So I'd never heard the term digital nomad, you know, never heard location independence. I think that happened a couple of years later that those terms started to be used. So even when I came back from my trip and decided, you know, I want to be able to continue to travel and I know there's work I could do from anywhere. So I set that all up without it being, you know, like a thing. And this was also, you know, it was before Twitter, it was before Facebook, before Instagram, obviously, like none of that stuff existed. And I think because of that, it's in some ways, I feel like it's kind of hard to tell how much things have, the number of people doing it has increased, which I do think it has. But I also think it's easier to find each other now, you know, because of Facebook and Twitter and so many more people having websites about it. And so that, you know, I sometimes wonder how many of us were doing something like this before, but we just didn't have a way to talk to each other. But it definitely seems to be growing. And of course, as it gets more attention, more people are finding out about it and thinking, oh, yeah, that is something I want to do too. And of course, as many people have told me on my interviews, and you mentioned this as well, the 4-hour work week, I don't know when that was published, but that also really, you know, some of these kind of more mainstream media and publications and things that have gotten out there are also spreading the word about some of these ideas. And so opening up to a larger audience. And I think, you know, I don't know to what, you know, like by what percentage things are going to increase or whatever, but I feel quite confident that it's just going to continue to grow and also to continue to change as people look at different ways to work, as new opportunities continue to appear. You know, like we didn't have Skype 10 years ago. What are we going to have in 10 years that we don't have now? And on the other side, you know, I think a lot of people who have been doing it for a while are starting to slow down a bit. And I think there's, you know, there's the nomad part of it, but then there's also just the location independence part of it. And I think, you know, no matter how much you want to travel or how much of a nomad you want to be, having the flexibility to work from anywhere is really huge. And I imagine that the number of people who could work from anywhere if they choose to is just going to continue to increase.
That sums it up really nicely. Like it's a growing trend, and also everything goes in the direction of making digital nomads' life easier, because basically in the end of the day, you're a remote worker, and now everything mm-hmm. is going in the direction of remote work. So yeah, that's pretty interesting. And what you mentioned about the being location free or a digital nomad, that's one of the most, I think, interesting subjects out there, because in the end of the day, maybe most of us are not that much into being digital nomad of constantly changing, but at least have the flexibility and freedom to change location. So it looks like it is growing, and it looks like there is a lot more information. So that's good news, I guess. Is it good news or bad news?
I think so. And you know, the other thing that I really hope to see in the coming years is more awareness of it, in the sense of more arrangements being made to make it easy for us to get visas and things like that. You know, like, I would be perfectly happy to pay for some kind of visa that would allow me to stay in a country longer, you know, and I just have to somehow show you like my, you know, nomad status or whatever, you know. And I think a lot of people feel that way, but we're like in this weird gray area. We're like, it's not a work visa. It's not really a tourist visa. It's like, what is it? And I really feel like there's an opportunity there for countries to welcome, you know, people doing what we're doing, if they just, you know, can set things up in the right way.
Yeah, I think countries totally do not understand this. If you're trying to explain, even if to the authorities in your country, what you're doing, needless to say, the authorities in other countries, they will simply not understand the concept of not being a tourist or not arriving strictly for work. So there's a lot of work to do there. And hopefully, yeah, like you said, there will be some kind of a digital nomad visa that allows you to just move from place to place. Because in the end of the day, I think digital nomads are really good for local economies. They're basically not working for clients in the local economies, and they still take a lot of money and bring a lot of knowledge. So, wow, that'll be great if it happens. That's going to be super cool. I wanted to ask you, after so many interviews that you've done in Nomatopia, what is the, let's say, if you look at the profile of nomads that are happy, that have been doing it for a long time without ditching the lifestyle, if you saw some characteristics out there of maybe some skills or characters, so when people are considering, okay, should I be a nomad or not, maybe if there are some common ground that you've seen of what do people do that actually work out, or what are the skills they have, or their let's say the way they look on life and so on. Is there something that you can identify, or everyone is so different from each other?
That's a really good question. I think definitely there are some common characteristics. I would say that they're all very flexible and, you know, kind of ready for anything. You know, they recognize that there are ups and downs, you know, whether that's in your income or just things going smoothly, or, you know, some places you're going to love, some places you won't like so much, and just recognizing that that's kind of all, you know, it's part of the package, right? And just enjoying and embracing all of it. I also think that there's also, one, a real spirit, you know, of exploration and adventure, but also like inner exploration. And I feel like I've had conversations with a lot of people on the podcast about how important it is to be constantly kind of questioning things and making sure that, but in a positive way, you know, in the sense of like, am I happy with the way this is going? And, maybe I don't like being in really cold weather. Okay, I need to change that. Or, you know, what's happening here that is not working for me? How can I make changes to be happier, to have things go more smoothly, whatever it might be? So it's that flexibility, but it's also, you know, having that awareness that that you can control things, right? And you can change things if they're not going your way, and paying attention to what you can do to continue to tweak and make things go even better.
That's good. Let's move on to the next one. Maybe one of the last questions of the locations, because you've been in many, many locations so far. So can you tell us on the community side, and also on life expenses and so on. Like, what are your favorite places that you would, for example, recommend to people to definitely check out?
Mm-hmm. It's tricky. There have been a lot of places that I have enjoyed, but I don't know if I would necessarily recommend them. And, you know, also, I'm always hesitant to tell people, like, you should really go to this place or that place, because the more I do this, the more I realize how much, you know, we're all looking for our own thing. Like, I would say the one thing that we're all looking for is good internet, right? Beyond that, we have a lot of different preferences and a lot of different priorities. Some people want to be by the beach. Some people only want warm weather. Some people want to be able to speak the language. I know you want to have the co-working space, you know, whatever it might be, everyone has their priorities. And there have been times I've gone somewhere that a lot of people were talking about and I didn't really like it that much. And so again, I think it's important to know yourself and to know what you enjoy and what's going to work for you. But in general, I would say, and you know, it comes up a lot, I think Chiang Mai was in Thailand was definitely a good location for us because the internet was pretty good. There is definitely a community of nomads there. And, you know, I went to a co-working / coffee shop, you know, a couple times a week to work and connect with people. And that was really good. But again, going back to things you're looking for, I felt limited by not being able to speak the language. And we also really liked Bali. We spent 2 months in Ubud, but I felt kind of the same there. You know, I felt kind of outside of the local culture. And that was kind of frustrating. And I felt like I wanted to find a way to bridge that gap somehow, which can be hard when, you know, you're not staying that long. Like 2 months is a significant amount of time, but it's different than, you know, our neighbor in the place we stayed. She was from Europe and she'd lived there for like 15 years, you know? So obviously her experience was different when you stay somewhere that long. So that's the short answer, kind of short answer.
Yeah, I guess you brought up something that is how easy it is to connect with the locals. And I guess that in places like South America, it's easier than in Asia, for example, because there is this element of more, I don't even know how to say it, like maybe it's more of a ability to communicate with people who are more in the mindset other than just watching people and saying, okay, that's really interesting. And I had the same thing as well, that in South America, I felt that I can connect a little bit more to the people than in Asia. And I guess this is something that is very, very important. And like you said, it all depends on what you're looking for, because South America can be very challenging from what I remember, basically on the security aspect. So you just brought another question into mind. Uh-huh. The security in South America, is it okay? Like, do you feel kind of safe there? Would you say that there are places to avoid, or you feel pretty good?
Yeah, well, knock on wood, I have never had any problems anywhere in the world. I've been very lucky in that sense, I guess. Lucky, smart, I don't know. but you know, obviously South America is a huge place and I haven't been everywhere. Buenos Aires in particular, which is what I know the best. I feel like it's not really any different from any other big city. You know, there are some neighborhoods that you might not want to be in, or maybe you would, you know, be cautious about walking around late at night. I guess I do take some added precautions there that I wouldn't take, like in the US, for example, in terms of, you know, like and this is true most of the world, honestly. But especially in Buenos Aires, I guess I don't carry my ATM card unless I'm going to the ATM, and credit cards and things like that. Just to, you know, minimize risk. And if someone's going to grab my bag, I'd rather there not be anything useful in it for them. So there are things like that I, you know, kind of maybe extra precautions that I take, but like I said, I've never had any problems there and I've always felt comfortable. One thing I do think is important to mention that is true in Argentina. I don't know if this is true other places. It might be something to kind of check out on a case by case basis. But, you know, a lot of us are used to being in the States or being in Europe, Australia, wherever you're from. And, you know, you've got your iPhone, you've got your iPad, and you just carry those things, you know, in your hand without thinking twice. And those Apple products in particular are a very hot commodity in Argentina because they're not really available locally. Like there's no Apple store in Buenos Aires or anything like that. And so those kinds of things can really be a target if people, you know, if thieves are looking for stuff to steal. So I'm definitely, and I don't have an iPad or an iPhone, but if I did, I would be definitely, I would, you know, be cautious about flashing it around in public places, because I've heard so many stories, you know, like I read, or a friend of a friend was using his iPad, you know, like reading in the park, and some guy came running past and like grabbed it out of his hands. Yeah. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that you might not think about normally, but recognizing that, you know, like, you can't just go buy an iPad at the store in Argentina, as far as I know. So, you know, those things, once you're aware of how appealing those things can be for people, then you realize, okay, yeah, this, I might not want to sit in the park with my iPad just in case.
I always do that, by the way. But I think that the idea of making the adjustments depending on where you go to is totally critical. And this has to do with awareness as well. And it's just about knowing what are the specific risks in each place and doing the adjustment. So if I get it correctly, basically you can't do what you do in one place. You have to keep on getting your alarm levels a little bit up and down according to where you are. And I basically had this in South America as well, because some places are safer. For example, Chile is super safe as a country. And when I crossed to Peru, I told myself as a mental note, like, okay, here it's going to be, here you have to be a little bit more aware of your surroundings and so on. So yeah, making those adjustments is super important. That's a really good thing. Yeah.
And I think also another tip is to pay attention to what the locals are doing. You know, and like the other thing I'm kind of probably overly sensitive about is like being out in public with my computer, you know, like just at some random coffee shop or whatever. Like, for example, if I have the option of sitting like right by the front window or sitting way in the back, I would probably sit in the back. Just so, you know, not every person walking past can see that I'm there with my computer. And so that can be something to look at. Like, are locals out at coffee shops with their computers? Are locals out with fancy phones on the street? You know, and kind of just see how do they handle these things. And then, you know, especially because you might stand out more than the locals, you know, I would, you know, take your lead from what the locals are doing, and then maybe even, you know, one more level of caution, whatever that might be for you.
So let's move on to the last question, which is basically, this is a tough question. I don't want people to ask me this question, but I'm gonna do it anyway. Uh-oh. So basically, no, it's nothing, but it's basically the idea of what are your plans in regard of the nomadic lifestyle? Because if someone asks me, I tell them, hey, no plans. Like, well, what are you talking about? Right. It's just, this is the lifestyle. But maybe, did you have it kind of figured out of, are you going to do the same thing for many years, or you're kind of have a scenario of this stopping, or did you think about this, or you kind of go with the flow just like me?
I think about it sometimes, but don't feel like, you know, I have to have it all figured out. I would say for both, you know, me and my husband, we have not, I would not say we have any specific plans to stop. It's not like this has an end date on it. You know, as I said before, and which I think everybody, it can be helpful for everyone, is to, you know, we're constantly looking at like, how long do we want to stay in places? Maybe we want to move around less, or, you know, which areas of the country or of the world do we want to be in? And so we were constantly making some adjustments in that sense. Probably the closest you could say to a plan is that, Buenos Aires has basically been our base because we have an apartment there. You know, my husband's family is there. I had been living there for a long time. So we go back at least once a year. But we've been thinking about maybe having a base somewhere else. And so we've been, you know, kind of going to other places with that in mind. And now that's part of the reason we're spending more time in Mexico, because we did find a place we like. But we haven't figured out the next part in terms of, well, what does that actually mean? Does that mean, you know, are we going to sell the place in Buenos Aires? Would we buy something somewhere else? Would we rather just not own any property? So that's, I guess I would say that it's kind of like on the horizon, but we haven't figured out, you know, what that looks like and what would actually be the steps we would take to make any big changes there.
Good. So I think, Amy, we're going to have to ask you to come again to the show and keep us updated in a year. So
all right.
We'll be up to date. And wow, that's been really great. A lot of good insights. So thanks a lot for showing up. And I encourage everyone to check your blog, Nomatopia, and the Facebook group and the podcast as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Great, so that's all for today. Just before we say goodbye, you can always go to becomenomad.com and read the summary of this interview, skillfully written by our editor, Molly. And on the blog, you can also subscribe to our nomadic newsletter to receive some cool updates every month. And that's basically it. Have a great weekend.